Welcome back to Office Hours. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Kiffer. Today we're on Lesson 2, The Rise of Public Health and Modern Surveillance. And honestly, I think of this lesson as the prequel to almost everything else in the course. Because before any intervention, any policy, any treatment can be evaluated, somebody has to count something.
That's the line I underlined when I read the module. Modern public health is in large part a counting project. The dead, the sick, the well, the exposed.
Right. And the capacity to count populations is so basic to what we do that it's easy to forget how recently it was invented. The whole apparatus you take for granted, life tables, death rates, surveillance systems, national agencies, almost none of it existed 300 years ago.
Last lesson, we did the conceptual layer. Disease versus illness versus sickness, the five models of health, the four founding documents. This one is more like the institutional and methodological backstory.
And the spine of the lesson is a timeline. We start in 17th century London with weekly broadsheets posted in parish churches listing every recent death. We end in the present with global pathogen surveillance systems that sequence emerging viruses within hours of detection. Between those two bookends sit some of the most consequential intellectual and institutional achievements in human history.
Okay, section one, the bills of mortality. Walk us into that London print shop.
From the late 1590s, the parish clerks of London were required to keep weekly records of deaths organized by cause. Those records were published as bills of mortality, single sheets printed cheaply, distributed for a penny or two, posted in churches and on city walls. They were originally intended to warn wealthy Londoners when plague had returned, so they knew when it was time to flee the city for their country estates.
So this isn't a public health project to begin with. It's a class warning system.
Pretty much. And they became, almost incidentally, the first sustained population-level health surveillance system anywhere in the world. The cause of death was recorded by what was called a searcher of the dead, typically an older woman appointed by the parish who examined the body, took family report, applied her own clinical judgment, and assigned a cause.
And the categories were?
Idiosyncratic, by modern standards. You'd see things like teeth, or griping in the guts, or rising of the lights, or consumption. But the key feature is they were consistent within parishes over time, which is what made longitudinal analysis possible. And three things about the bills are striking from a modern public health perspective. They were universal within their jurisdiction, every death, every parish. They were temporal, weekly, allowing time series analysis, and they were publicly available at trivial cost.
Those three features, universal coverage, regular temporal cycle, public availability, are basically what any modern surveillance system aspires to.
And London's bills had them by accident, motivated by plague terror and parish accounting, more than two centuries before any other city did.
Then in 1662, John Grant sits down with this pile of broadsheets.
John Grant, a London haberdasher, a small businessman with no formal scientific training. In 1662, he published a slim volume called Natural and Political Observations Made Upon the Bills of Mortality. And the book did what nobody had done before. It aggregated the bills, it analyzed them, and it treated the resulting numbers as facts about populations rather than as records of individuals.
That sounds like a small move. It's a huge move.
It is the move. Before Grant, mortality data was a series of individual events. Each death was its own moral and clinical event. Grant looked at thousands of them at once and saw patterns no individual event could reveal. Seasonal mortality, sex ratios at birth. He calculated the proportion of children dying before age six. He estimated 36%. And modern reanalysis says that's about right for the era. And he produced the first life table.
Which is what?
An estimate of how many of 100 people born in a given year would survive to age 6, 16, 26, 36, and so on. The life table is now the foundational data structure of demography and actuarial science. Every life expectancy estimate you've ever seen descends from Grant's invention.
And the Royal Society took him seriously.
They elected him a fellow. King Charles II reportedly remarked that if they found any more such tradesmen, they should be admitted without further ado, which is a charming line. Grant is the founder of demography and one of the founders of modern epidemiology.
Then two centuries later, the project takes its modern form under William Farr.
Farr, 1807 to 1883, a country doctor's son, trained in medicine in Paris, which at the time was the world capital of clinical medicine. In 1838, he's appointed compiler of abstracts at the newly established UK General Register Office, and he holds that position for 41 years.
41 years. That's the kind of institutional tenure that lets you actually change a field.
Yeah, and he did. Four contributions. First, he standardized cause of death coding. Before FAR, every jurisdiction used its own categories. After FAR, a death was classified using a nomenclature that allowed comparison across districts and over time. His system is the direct ancestor of the modern International Classification of Diseases, ICD, now in its 11th revision, used by every country in the world.
Second,
death rates, deaths per 1,000 population per year, rather than counts, sounds obvious now, was a huge methodological advance. It let you compare districts of different sizes and populations changing in size over time. Third, age-specific mortality rates, which let you analyze how risk varied across the life course. And fourth, he pioneered systematic publication of vital statistics in annual reports that became models for similar reports in other countries.
And he was a political player as well.
Absolutely. He used his data to make political arguments that overcrowded housing produced excess deaths, that certain trades had unusually high mortality, that the poor died younger than the rich. He was an early student of cholera. He famously clashed with Florence Nightingale over the best way to visualize sanitary mortality data during the Crimean War, and he lived to see his system adopted across the British Empire and emulated worldwide.
And the module makes a point I want to pause on. Population thinking is a learned habit of mind, not a natural one.
Yeah, this is worth dwelling on. Even highly intelligent people who lived before Grant didn't naturally think in terms of populations. They thought in terms of individuals, families, at most parishes. The idea that a city's deaths form a population about which generalizations can be made, that there are typical mortality patterns, expected values, excess deaths in unusual years, is a habit you have to be taught.
And modern public health is full of situations where natural cognition resists population thinking.
Risk perception is the classic case. Humans are really good at recognizing immediate threats, a car bearing down, a hot stove, and pretty bad at thinking about diffuse statistical threats. 2% annual mortality, 1 in 10,000 vaccine adverse event. The work of public health communication is partly the work of translating population statistics into terms that natural cognition can grasp without distortion.
Okay, section 2 of the lesson, shoe leather epidemiology, Snow and Chadwick.
Right. If Grant invented population data and FAR standardized it, two men in mid-19th century London showed what you could do with that data if you also got out and walked around.
Chadwick first.
Edwin Chadwick, 1800 to 1890, trained as a barrister, spent most of his career as a civil servant and reformer. He'd been secretary to Jeremy Bentham, the utilitarian philosopher, and he carried Bentham's commitment to systematic evidence-based reform throughout his life. In 1839, the Royal Commission on the Health of Towns was established. Chadwick was its driving force. And in 1842, he published the resulting report on the sanitary condition of the laboring population of Great Britain.
And the contents were?
Brutal. With statistics, with chilling detail, he documented the conditions in working-class neighborhoods of British industrial cities. Open sewers in the streets, privies shared by dozens of families, water supplies contaminated by sewage, houses with no ventilation, occupied by entire families in single rooms, infant mortality of 250 to 300 per thousand live births in the worst districts, compared to 60 to 80 in middle-class areas of the same cities, working-class life expectancy of 15 to 20 years versus 35 to 40 for the gentry.
That gap is, those are different worlds.
Same city, different worlds, and the numbers themselves weren't new. FAR statistics had been showing them for years. What Chadwick did was combine them with firsthand investigation and political argument in a way that made them politically impossible to ignore.
And he was famously hard to work with.
Authoritarian, certain of his own correctness, impatient with disagreement. Even his allies disliked him personally, but he was indefatigable. The sanitary report drove the UK Public Health Act of 1848, which established the General Board of Health, required local authorities to provide sanitation infrastructure, and inspired analogous legislation in other countries. The medical officer of health, a public health official appointed by a local authority with statutory powers and responsibility for the health of a defined population, that institution dates to this era. Still a fixture of British, Canadian, Australian, and many other countries' public health systems.
Then Snow.
John Snow, 1813 to 1858, physician and anesthesiologist. He had a long-standing interest in cholera and a healthy skepticism of dominant medical theories. In late August 1854, an outbreak of cholera began in the Soho district of London, centered on a single street called Broad Street.
What did the outbreak look like?
Savage, even by Victorian standards. From August 31st through September 9th, more than 500 people died in a roughly 10-block area. Whole families wiped out within hours. Survivors fled in panic. By the time the outbreak ended in mid-September, about 616 people had died, more than 10% of the district's population, in a couple of weeks.
And Snow already had a theory.
He'd published a monograph in 1849, revised 1855, arguing, and against prevailing miasmatic opinion, that cholera was transmitted by a contagious agent acting through ingestion, most likely via contaminated water. So when the Broad Street outbreak happened, he had a hypothesis to test.
Walk us through his method.
Painstaking. He went door to door in the affected area, recording the address of each cholera death, eventually plotting them as bars on a map of the neighborhood. He inquired about each household's water source, and he identified that the deaths clustered tightly around a single public water pump on Broad Street.
And then he started looking at the exceptions.
Which is where the investigation gets really beautiful. The workhouse in the middle of the outbreak zone had its own water supply and few deaths. The Lion Brewery on Broad Street, workers drank beer rather than water. No deaths. And he tracked a death in Hampstead miles away to a woman who had a barrel of Broad Street water, delivered each day because she preferred its taste. Each exception strengthens the hypothesis. The deaths track the water, not the air.
And he goes to the local authority.
September 7th, he presents the findings to the Board of Guardians of St. James's Parish, recommends the handle of the Broad Street pump be removed. After some debate, the board agrees. Pump handle comes off on September 8th. Outbreak ends within days.
And the module is careful to note this is a more complicated story than it gets told.
Right, because the outbreak was already declining. Most of the susceptible population had been infected or had fled. The board was not fully convinced of Snow's theory. The miasma theorists kept arguing that the cause was bad air rising from a plague pit beneath Broad Street. A full investigation by Farr's General Register Office, completed in 1855, said the cause was uncertain. It would be another decade before germ theory provided the mechanistic explanation that vindicated him.
But Snow's intellectual achievement was substantial regardless.
And it's exemplary. He worked at the level of disease distribution, not mechanism. He didn't need to know what cholera was made of. He only needed to know where it was, when it appeared, and what its cases had in common. That is the deep methodological insight at the heart of epidemiology. You can act usefully on a disease whose causal agent is unknown, provided you can characterize its distribution well enough to find an intervention point.
That's the same logic that guided the early HIV response.
Right. Sexual transmission was identified before the virus was. The early COVID response in 2020, respiratory transmission, was identified before the variant landscape was understood. The same logic. Snow's spot map of the Broad Street outbreak is one of the most reproduced diagrams in public health history. It's the founding image of the field. And if you're ever in London, the pump still stands.
And there's a second Snow study people know less well.
Yeah, the Grand Experiment, published in 1855. It's actually more methodologically sophisticated than the Broad Street investigation. The setup, South London was supplied with drinking water by two private companies, the Lambeth Waterworks and the Southwark and Vauxhall Company. In the 1840s, both companies drew water from the heavily polluted Thames within central London. In 1852, the Lambeth Company moved its intake upstream to Thames Ditton, drawing relatively clean water from above the city's sewage discharge. Southwark and Vauxhall did not move.
So you have two companies with overlapping service areas.
Right, houses on the same streets, sometimes adjacent, supplied by different companies based on historical agreements. And Snow recognized that this constituted a natural experiment of extraordinary power. He surveyed cholera deaths in South London during the 1853 to 54 epidemic, identified each household's water supplier. Result was dramatic. Cholera mortality was roughly 8 times higher among Southwark and Vauxhall customers than Lambeth customers. The difference was confined entirely to the period after the Lambeth Company had moved its intake.
And the experiment was done by the water companies. Snow just recognized it.
That's the move. Recognize that nature has created a comparison that experiment couldn't, and extract the inference. The Grand Experiment is now taught as the founding example of natural experiment methodology and epidemiology. Mendelian randomization, regression, discontinuity, instrumental variables. All of those descend from Snow's basic insight. They get formalized in the methods courses later in the sequence.
Okay, section 3, institutions. And the lesson makes a point that I think students underestimate. The major institutions are all post-Second World War. Some of them are younger than students in the room.
Right. The World Health Organization, founded April 7th, 1948, the date now marked annually as World Health Day. Its constitution had been drafted by a preparatory commission led by the Brazilian physician Geraldo de Paula Sousa and the Yugoslav epidemiologist Andrija Štampar, both founding figures of modern global health. 61 countries signed at the outset. Today, there are 194 WHO member states.
And the WHO's signature first campaign was
smallpox eradication, launched in 1959, intensified under Director General Halfdan Mahler from 1973, certified successful on May 8, 1980, led on the ground by Donald Henderson and a remarkable international team, used the surveillance containment strategy, ring vaccination around each case as its core operational approach. Smallpox remains the only human disease ever eradicated, and the campaign's playbook still informs modern outbreak response.
What's the WHO's structure?
Dual, a secretariat headquartered in Geneva with regional offices around the world, and a governance body, the World Health Assembly, composed of representatives from all member states, meeting annually in Geneva each May. The Director General serves at the pleasure of the Assembly, and the WHO's power is, on one reading, surprisingly limited. It can convene, recommend, coordinate. It cannot compel member states to do anything.
Which became really visible during COVID.
Hugely. The 2005 international health regulations require member states to report outbreaks of international concern, but compliance varies. And the WHO's funding comes partly from member state dues, which is a small fraction of the budget, and largely from voluntary contributions, mostly from wealthy member states and from private donors, including the Gates Foundation. That funding structure has been criticized for producing donor-driven priorities and limiting institutional autonomy.
Then the CDC,
the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, traces to July 1, 1946, when the Communicable Disease Center was established in Atlanta, Georgia, with an initial mandate to combat malaria in the American South. Atlanta was chosen because the southern states had the highest malaria burden. The agency took over offices and staff from the Wartime Malaria Control in War Areas program. Then it expanded rapidly. Tuberculosis, sexually transmitted infections, foodborne outbreaks, polio, and by the 1950s, vaccine-preventable disease surveillance.
And the famous Epidemic Intelligence Service.
Founded in 1951, two-year training program that places epidemiologists at federal, state, and local health departments to investigate outbreaks. EIS officers have been at the center of nearly every major U.S. public health investigation of the past 70 years. They've been deployed internationally as well.
And the CDC's MMWR, the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report,
launched in 1952, Journal of Record for U.S. Public Health Surveillance. The first cases of what would become recognized as HIV/AIDS were reported in the MMWR on June 5, 1981, one of the most consequential single publications in the history of the journal.
And the lesson is honest about what COVID did to the CDC's reputation.
Yeah. Took unprecedented damage during the pandemic. Early case definitions, testing rollout, communication with the public, widely criticized. A 2022 internal review led by Director Rochelle Walensky proposed substantial reforms. Whether they're sufficient is contested. From a Canadian student perspective, the CDC's recent troubles are a useful caution. Institutions built over 75 years can erode quickly under political and administrative pressure.
Then PHAC, which is the Canadian story, and which is much younger than students assume.
The Public Health Agency of Canada was created in September 2004 in direct response to a specific crisis, February through June 2003, SARS, Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome. It hit Toronto particularly hard, 44 deaths in Canada and substantial economic disruption. The Federal Naylor Commission reviewed Canada's pandemic response and identified profound gaps in national coordination. Case reporting was inconsistent. No federal body was clearly in charge. Communication with provinces was ad hoc. PHAC was created to fill those gaps.
And it runs the National Microbiology Laboratory in Winnipeg.
Canada's reference laboratory for high-consequence pathogens, one of the few BSL-4 facilities in North America. PHAC's first chief public health officer was David Butler Jones. The current one, Theresa Tam, became a national public figure during COVID.
And Canadian public health is constitutionally complicated.
That's an understatement. Healthcare delivery is a provincial responsibility under the Canada Health Act. Public health is primarily provincial as well, with federal responsibility limited to specific areas. International coordination, interprovincial coordination, Indigenous health in some contexts, military health, customs and borders, federal employees. So you get a federal provincial governance challenge that COVID exposed. PHAC can convene the provinces and territories, but it can't compel them. Case definitions, reporting formats, even basic vocabulary varied across jurisdictions during COVID, making national synthesis difficult.
Below the federal level, you have provincial agencies.
BCCDC, the BC Center for Disease Control, was founded in 1939, originally as the BC Public Health Laboratory. It became internationally visible during COVID for its data dashboards, the regular public briefings led by Provincial Health Officer Bonnie Henry, and provincial leadership in genomic surveillance. Below the provincial level, public health is regional. In BC, there are 5 regional health authorities, each with their own medical health officers and public health staff. Ontario has 34 public health units, each with a medical officer of health.
And we mentioned the First Nations Health Authority briefly last lesson.
Yeah, established in 2013, first Indigenous-controlled provincial-level public health authority in Canada, a critical recent addition to the institutional landscape. Yukon and the Northwest Territories are in different stages of similar transitions. Other Canadian jurisdictions are watching closely.
Practical takeaway for a student.
Know your jurisdiction. International coordination is WHO. Federal level surveillance and emergency response is PHAC. Provincial level public health policy is your provincial public health office. BCCDC in BC. Public Health Ontario, INSPQ in Quebec. Local outbreak response is your regional or local public health unit. Knowing which level owns which question is the first move in any operational public health task.
One more thing on this section. The module flags what COVID revealed about the surveillance system.
Mixed picture, genomic surveillance performed brilliantly. SARS-CoV-2 was sequenced and shared globally within days of identification. That was built largely on flu and HIV infrastructure that the field had invested in for decades. Traditional case counting performed poorly. Definitions varied, denominators were unclear, comparison across jurisdictions was nearly impossible. Wastewater surveillance, an old idea, found new life when traditional case data became unreliable. The Public Health Agency of Canada now operates a national wastewater surveillance program through 2026.
Okay, section 4, the standing studies.
A handful of long-running cohort studies and population surveys produce most of what we currently know about chronic disease, behavioral risk factors, and the social distribution of health. Students don't need to know their methods yet, that's later in the sequence, but they should know their names, founding dates, what they study, what they've contributed, because they'll reappear in nearly every module of this course.
6 big ones to cover. Framingham British Doctors, Whitehall Nurses Health, N. Haynes, and the Canadian flagship surveys, Framingham First.
The Framingham Heart Study was launched in 1948 in the town of Framingham, Massachusetts, by the U.S. National Heart Institute. The original cohort, 5,209 men and women aged 30 to 62 with no overt cardiovascular disease, examined every 2 years, followed prospectively. A second-generation offspring study enrolled in 1971, grandchildren added in 2002, a third generation later. Framingham investigators have collected what may be the most extensive longitudinal data set on cardiovascular disease in human history.
And the signature contribution is
the term risk factor. The concept that specific characteristics, smoking, hypertension, elevated cholesterol, diabetes, are statistically associated with subsequent disease, introduced by Framingham investigators in a 1961 paper by Cannell and colleagues. Risk factor is so standard now, it's hard to remember somebody had to invent the phrase. Framingham also produced the original cardiovascular risk equation, the Framingham risk score, still used clinically in modified form to estimate 10-year cardiovascular risk.
And there are limits on Framingham's generalizability.
Yeah, significant ones. The original cohort was overwhelmingly white middle class from a specific New England town. The risk equations systematically overestimate risk in lower prevalence populations and have been recalibrated for use elsewhere. The Canadian Cardiovascular Society's risk equations are Framingham derived but adjusted for Canadian populations. And the cohort's age and demographic profile limit what it can say about cardiovascular disease in women, Black Americans, Asian populations. Gaps that more recent cohorts like the multi-ethnic study of atherosclerosis and the Jackson Heart Study have been built to address.
British Doctor Study.
Richard Dahl and Austin Bradford Hill. 1951, 34,439 male British doctors followed for the rest of their lives. The purpose was to test the recently proposed hypothesis that smoking causes lung cancer, and the findings were unambiguous. Doctors who smoked had 14 times the lung cancer mortality of non-smokers. Doctors who quit reversed much of the excess risk.
The 50-year follow-up.
Dahl and colleagues, BMJ 2004, showed that lifelong smokers lost roughly 10 years of life expectancy compared to non-smokers. The British Doctor Study is the founding cohort of behavioral epidemiology and provided much of the empirical basis for the 1964 U.S. Surgeon General's report on smoking. Connection point to last lesson. This is exactly the kind of evidence Lalonde was drawing on when he argued in 1974 that lifestyle was one of the four health fields.
Whitehall.
Michael Marmot and colleagues. Whitehall 1 started in 1967, followed 17,530 male British civil servants across employment grades. Whitehall 2 started in 1985, including women, with more extensive psychosocial and biological measurement. And the findings reshaped social epidemiology. Mortality followed a clear stepwise gradient. Men in the lowest civil service grade had roughly three times the mortality of men in the highest grade. And crucially, the gradient was not just bottom versus top. It was stepwise across all five grades.
Even more strikingly,
controlling for smoking, blood pressure, cholesterol, body mass, physical activity reduced but did not eliminate the gradient. Something about hierarchy itself, Marmot argued, control over work, was producing health effects. The Whitehall findings are arguably the most cited evidence in social epidemiology. They reframed how public health thinks about poverty and health, not as a problem of the poor, which you'd fix by targeting them, as a problem of the gradient, which requires addressing the structure of the hierarchy itself.
Nurses' Health Study.
Launched at Harvard in 1976 under Frank Spicer and Walter Willett, originally designed to evaluate the health effects of oral contraceptives. Recruited 121,700 married female registered nurses aged 30 to 55. A second cohort added in 1989 with 116,000 younger nurses. A third in 2010. The nurses' health studies collectively have produced more than 5,000 peer-reviewed publications, the most productive cohort studies in history.
Contribution span basically everything.
Hormone therapy, dietary patterns, type 2 diabetes risk factors, cancer epidemiology, lifestyle, and depression. And the studies are methodologically influential, as one of the first cohorts to use mailed self-administered questionnaires for both exposure and outcome assessment, validated against biomarker subsamples. That approach has been both criticized, measurement error in self-reported diet is real, and defended the size and duration of the cohort produced statistical power that biomarker validated subsets cannot match.
And Haynes?
The National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. U.S. government survey conducted by the National Center for Health Statistics. Continuous cycles since 1999, predecessors going back to 1959. And ANES is methodologically distinct from the cohorts. It's a series of repeated cross-sectional samples, not a longitudinal cohort. Each cycle recruits about 5,000 individuals representative of the U.S. population for in-depth interview, physical examination, and laboratory testing. And Haynes is the gold standard for population-level biomarker surveillance. Source of U.S. data on blood lead, serum cholesterol, blood pressure, hemoglobin, A1C, and exposure biomarkers for thousands of environmental chemicals.
And the Canadian flagships.
Canadian Community Health Survey, the CCHS, conducted by Statistics Canada continuously since 2000. Recruits about 65,000 Canadians annually, age 12 and over, stratified to be representative at the provincial and health region level, core content on chronic conditions, mental health, healthcare use, behaviors, demographics, plus rotating modules on specific topics. CCHS data is the foundation of much Canadian public health surveillance. The self-rated health item we mentioned last lesson lives on the CCHS.
And the Canadian Longitudinal Study on Aging?
CLSA, launched 2010 under Parminder Raina, Christina Wolfson, and others. Recruited 51,338 Canadians age 45 to 85 at baseline. Followed every 3 years with both interview-only and comprehensive in-clinic components. Collects survey data, physical measurements, biospecimens, and links to administrative health data. One of the world's most comprehensive aging cohorts. More than 600 peer-reviewed publications already.
And there are several other major Canadian programs.
The Canadian Cancer Registry, the Canadian Institute for Health Information, CIHI, which manages large administrative health data sets, hospitalizations, physician services, Provincial administrative data sets, and particularly Ontario's ICES holdings, have produced extraordinary research, including some of the largest pharmacoepidemiological studies in the world. PHAC's Maternity Experiences Survey, the Canadian Tobacco, Alcohol and Drug Survey each fill specific surveillance gaps.
Practical advice for a student.
Now, which data set answers your question? Different data sets, different sampling frames, different measurement approaches. Different research and policy questions get appropriately answered by different data sources. The methods courses later in the sequence will teach you how to think about which design fits which question. This lesson just wants you to know they exist and have names you can use.
Let me try to pull this together into the synthesis. 7 takeaways.
Cool.
First, modern public health is, at its base, a counting project. Before you can intervene or evaluate, somebody has to count something. And the capacity to count populations was invented, not given.
Second, the inventors had names. John Grant, 1662, took the London bills of mortality and turned individual deaths into population patterns. He founded demography. William Farr, 2 centuries later, built the institutional machinery, standardized coding, death rates, age-specific analysis, the General Register Office, and made population counting routine.
Third, Snow and Chadwick showed what you could do with that counting infrastructure if you also got out and walked around. Chadwick's 1842 sanitary report drove the 1848 Public Health Act and the Medical Officer of Health Institution. Snow's 1854 Broad Street investigation worked at the level of distribution, not mechanism, and is the founding case of shoe leather epidemiology. His grand experiment a year later is the founding example of natural experiment methodology.
Fourth, the major institutions are all post-war and mostly more recent than people assume. WHO 1948, CDC 1946, PHAC only 2004, created in direct response to SARS. Canadian public health is constitutionally complicated. The federal can convene, can't compel.
Fifth, COVID was the largest single stress test of the contemporary surveillance system. Genomic surveillance excelled. Traditional case counting struggled. Wastewater surveillance found new utility. Reforms are underway in 2026.
Sixth, 6 standing studies you'll meet again and again. Framingham gave us risk factor and the cardiovascular risk equations. British doctors established the smoking link. Whitehall established the social gradient and the role of hierarchy and control over work. Nurses' health is the most productive cohort in history. NH Ains is the U.S. biomarker gold standard. CCHS and CLSA are Canada's flagships.
And seventh, knowing which institution owns which question, which data set answers which question, and which method produced which finding. That's the operational literacy you build over a public health career. This lesson is your map.
That's a good summary. And the capstone milestone this week builds on it directly. Students take their chosen health topic and build a surveillance timeline. When was it first counted? Where? By whom? What's the main standing data source for it in Canada today? What's not well counted about it and why? Because every topic was invisible to public health until somebody decided to count it.
Next lesson, we move into specific content, infectious disease, sanitation, and hygiene, the germ theory revolution we previewed today, and the public health interventions that flowed from it. That's lesson 3.
Read the module, do the knowledge checks, bring questions to class.
Thanks for listening. See you in lesson 3.
Take care of yourselves. See you in class.